Side 15. The Bachman Books. Four Early Novels. Continuing with Road Work. On page 452.
They're not going to be here, she said. They're going to spend Christmas with Joanna.
Joanna was Joanna St. Clair, Jean Calloway's cousin, who lived in Minnesota. They had been close friends in their girlhood. Back in that pleasant lull between the War of 1812 and the advent of the Confederacy, he sometimes thought. And Joanna had had a stroke in July. She was still trying to get over it. But Jean had told him and Mary that the doctor said she could go at any time.
That must be nice, he thought, having a time bomb built right into your head like that.
Hey, bomb, is it today?
Please, not today. I haven't finished the new Victoria Holt.
Bart, are you there?
Yes, I was wool gathering.
Is 1 o'clock all right?
That's fine.
Was there anything else?
No, uh-uh.
Well?
Take good care, Mary.
I will. Bye, Bart.
Goodbye.
They hung up, and he wandered into the kitchen to make himself a drink. The woman he had just talked to on the phone wasn't the same woman that had sat tearfully on the living room couch less than a month ago, pleading for some reason to help explain the tidal wave that had just swept grandly through her ordered life, destroying the work of 20 years and leaving only a few sticks poking out of the mudflats. It was amazing. He shook his head over it the way he would have shaken his head over the news that Jesus had come down from the sky and had taken Richard Nixon up to heaven upon wheels of fire. She has regained herself. More, she had regained a person he hardly knew at all, a girl-woman he barely remembered. Like an archaeologist, she had excavated that person, and the person was a little stiff in the joints from its long storage, but still perfectly usable. The joints would ease, and the new old person would be a whole woman, perhaps scarred by this upheaval, but not seriously hurt. He knew her perhaps better than she thought. And he had been able to tell, strictly from the tone of her voice, that she was moving ever close to the idea of divorce, the idea of a clean break with the past, a break that would splint well and leave no trace of a limp. She was 38. Half of her life was ahead of her. There were no children to be casually maimed in the car wreck of this marriage. He would not suggest divorce, but if she did, he would agree. He envied her new person and her new beauty. And if she looked back 10 years from now on her marriage as a long, dark corridor leading into sunlight, he could feel sorry she felt that way, but he couldn't blame her. No, he couldn't blame her. December 21st, 1973. He had given her the presents in Jean Calloway's ticking ormolu living room. And the conversation that followed had been stilted and awkward. He had never been in this room alone with her, and he kept feeling that they should neck. It was a rusty, knee-jerk reaction that made him feel like a bad double exposure of his college self.
"Did you lighten your hair?"
he asked.
"Just a shade." She shrugged a little.
"It's nice. Makes you look younger."
"You're getting a little gray around the temples, Bart. Makes you look distinguished."
"Bullshit, it makes me look ratty."
She laughed, a little too high-pitched, and looked at the presents on the little side table.
He had wrapped the owl pin, had left the toys and the chess set for her to do. The dolls looked blankly at the ceiling, waiting for some little girl's hands to bring them to life. He looked at Mary. Their eyes caught seriously for a moment, and he thought irrevocable words were going to spill out of her, and he was frightened. Then the cuckoo jumped out of the clock, announced 1:30, and they both jumped and then laughed. The moment had passed. He got up so it wouldn't come around again. "Saved by a cuckoo bird," he thought. "That fits."
"Got to go," he said.
"An appointment?"
"Job interview."
"Really?"
She looked glad.
"Where? Who? How much?"
He laughed and shook his head. "There's a dozen other applicants with as good a chance as me. I'll tell you when I get it."
"Conceited."
"Sure."
Bart, what are you doing Christmas? She looked concerned and solemn, and it suddenly came to him that an invitation to Christmas dinner, and not to some New Year's divorce court, had been the thing on her lips inside.
God!
He almost sprayed laughter.
I'm going to eat at home.
You can come here, she said. It would be just the two of us.
No,
he said thoughtfully, and then more firmly, no. Emotions have a way of getting out of hand during the holidays. Another time. She was nodding, also thoughtfully. Will you be eating alone? He asked.
I can go to Bob and Janet's. Really, are you sure?
Yes.
Well,
but she looked relieved. They walked to the door and shared a bloodless kiss. I'll call you, he said.
You better.
Give my best to Bobby.
I will.
He was halfway down the walk to the car when she called, Bart! Bart, wait a minute!
He turned almost fearfully.
I almost forgot, she said. Wally Hamner called and invited us to his New Year's party. I accepted for both of us.
But if you don't want to...
Wally? He frowned. Walter Hamner was about their only crosstown friend. He worked for a local ad agency. Doesn't he know we're, you know, separated?
He knows, but you know Walt. Things like that don't faze him much.
Indeed they didn't. Just thinking about Walter made him smile. Walter, always threatening to quit advertising in favor of Advanced Trust Design, composer of obscene limericks and even more obscene parodies of popular tunes, divorced twice and tagged hard both times. Now impotent, if you believed gossip, and in this case, he thought the gossip was probably true. How long had it been since he had seen Walt? 4 months? 6? Too long. That might be fun, he said. And then a thought struck him. She scanned it from his face in her old way and said, There won't be any laundry people there. He and Steve Ordner know each other. Well, yes, him. He shrugged to show how unlikely she thought it was that him would be there. And the shrug turned into an elbow-holding little shiver. It was only about 25 degrees. Hey, go on in, he said. You'll freeze, dummy. Do you want to go? I don't know. I have to think about it. He kissed her again, this time a little more firmly, and she kissed back. At a moment like this, he could regret everything. But the regret was far away, clinical.
Merry Christmas, Bart, she said,
and he saw she was crying a little. Next year will be better, he said. The phrase, comforting but without any root meaning. Go inside before you catch pneumonia. She went in and he drove away, still thinking about Wally Hamner's New Year's Eve party. He thought he would go. December 24th, 1973. He found a small garage in Norton that would replace the broken back window for $90. When he asked the garage man if he would be working the day before Christmas, the garage man said, Hell yes, I'll take it any way I can get it. He stopped on the way at a Norton You Wash It and put his clothes in two machines. He automatically rotated the agitators to see what kind of shape the spring dries were in, and then loaded them carefully so each machine would extract, only in the laundromats they called it spin dry, without kicking off on the overload. He paused, smiling a little. You can take the boy out of the laundry, Fred, but you can't take the laundry out of the boy. Right, Fred? Fred? Oh, fuck yourself. That's a hell of a hole, the garage man said, peering at the spider-webbed glass. Kid with a snowball, he said. Rock in the middle of it. It was, he said. It really was. When the window was replaced, he drove back to the You Wash It, put his clothes in the dryer, set it to medium hot, and put 30 cents in the slot. He sat down and picked up someone's discarded newspaper. The You Wash It's only other customer was a tired-looking young woman with wire-rimmed glasses and blonde streaks in her long, reddish-brown hair. She had a small girl with her, and the small girl was throwing a tantrum.
I want my bottle!
God damn it, Rachel.
Bottle!
Daddy's going to spank you when we get home, the young woman promised grimly. And no treats before bed.
Bottle!
Now, why does a young girl like that want to streak her hair, he wondered, and looked at the paper. The headline said, "Small crowds in Bethlehem, pilgrims fear holy terror." On the bottom of page one, a short news story caught his eye, and he read it carefully. Winterberger says acts of vandalism will not be tolerated. Local. Victor Winterberger, Democratic candidate for the seat of the late Donald P. Nash, who was killed in a car crash late last month, said yesterday that acts of vandalism, such as the one that caused almost $100,000 worth of damage at the Route 784 construction site early last Wednesday, cannot be tolerated in a civilized American city. Winterberger made his remarks at an American Legion dinner and received a standing ovation. "We have seen what has happened in other cities," Winterberger said. "The defaced buses and subway cars and buildings in New York, the broken windows and senselessly marred schools of Detroit and San Francisco, the abuse of public facilities, public museums, public galleries. We must not allow the greatest country in the world to be overrun with Huns and barbarians." Police were called to the Grand Street area of the construction when a number of fires and explosions were seen by... Continued, page 5, column 2. He folded the paper and put it on top of a tattered pile of magazines. The washer hummed and hummed, a low, soporific sound. Huns. Barbarians. They were the Huns. They were the rippers and chewers and choppers, turning people out of their homes, kicking apart lives as a small boy might kick apart an anthill. The young woman dragged her daughter, still crying for a bottle, out of the U-washer. He closed his eyes and dozed off, waiting for his dryer to finish. A few minutes later, he snapped awake, thinking he heard fire bells, but it was only a Salvation Army Santa who had taken up his position on the corner out front. When he left the laundry with his basket of clothes, he threw all his pocket change into Santa's pot. "God bless you," Santa said. December 25th, 1973. The telephone woke him around 10 in the morning. He fumbled the extension off the night table, put it to his ear, and an operator said crisply into his sleep, "Will you accept a collect call from Olivia Brenner?" He was lost and could only fumble, "What? Who? I'm asleep." A distant, slightly familiar voice said, "Oh, for Christ's sake." And he knew. "Yes," he said, "I'll take it." Had she hung up on him? He got up on one elbow to see. "Olivia, you there?" "Go ahead, please." The operator overrode him, not willing to vary her psalm. "Olivia, are you there?" "I'm here." The voice was crackling and distant. "I'm glad you called." "I didn't think you'd take the call." "I just woke up. Are you there, in Las Vegas?" "Yes," she said flatly. The word came out with curiously dull authority, like a plank dropped on a cement floor. "Well, how is it? How are you doing?" Her sigh was so bitter that it was almost a tearless sob. "Not so good." "No?" "I met a guy my third night here. Went to a party and got so fucked up." "Dope?" he asked cautiously, very aware that this was long distance and the government was everywhere. "Dope?" she echoed crossly. "Of course it was dope. Bad shit, full of decks or something. I think I got raped." The last trailed off so badly that he had to ask, "What?" "Raped!" she screamed, so loudly that the receiver distorted. "That's when some stupid jock-playing Friday night hippie plays hide the salami with you while your brains are somewhere behind you, dripping off the wall. Rape, do you know what rape is?" "I know," he said. "Bullshit, you know." "Do you need money?" "Why ask me that? I can't fuck you over the telephone. I can't even hand job you." "I have some money," he said. "I could send it. That's all. That's why." Instinctively, he found himself speaking not soothingly, but softly, so she would have to slow down and listen. "Yeah, yeah." "Do you have an address?" "General Delivery, that's my address." "You don't have an apartment?" "Yeah, me and this other sad sack have got a place. The mailboxes are all broken." "Never mind, you keep the money." "I've got a job." "Screw, I think I'm going to quit and come back." "Merry Christmas to me." What's the job? Pushing hamburgers in this fast food joint. They got slots in the lobby and people play them and eat hamburgers all night long. Can you believe it? The last thing you have to do when your shift is over is to wipe off all the handles of the slot machines. They get all covered with mustard and mayo and catsup. And you should see the people here. All of them are fat. They've either got tans or burns. And if they don't want to fuck you, you're just part of the furniture. I've had offers from both sexes. Thank God my roomie's about as sex-oriented as a juniper bush. Oh, Christ, why am I telling you all this? I don't even know why I called you. I'm going to hitch out of here at the end of the week when I get paid. He heard himself say, give it a month.
What?
Don't go chicken shit. If you leave now, you'll always wonder what you went out there for. Did you play football in high school? I bet you did. I wasn't even the water boy.
Then you don't know anything, do you?
I'm thinking about killing myself.
You don't even... What did you say?
I'm thinking about killing myself. He said it calmly. He was no longer thinking about long distance and the people who might monitor long distance just for the fun of it. Ma Bell, the White House, the CIA, the FBI. I keep trying things and they keep not working. It's because I'm a little too old for them to work, I think. Something went wrong a few years ago, and I knew it was a bad thing, but I didn't know it was bad for me. I thought it just happened, and then I was going to get over it. But things keep falling down inside me. I'm sick with it. I keep doing things.
Have you got cancer? She whispered.
I think I do.
You ought to go to a hospital. Get
it's soul cancer.
You're ego-tripping, man.
Maybe so. He said,
it doesn't matter.
One way or the other, things are set, and they'll turn out the way they will. Only one thing that bothers me, and that's a feeling I get from time to time, that I'm a character in some bad writer's book, and he's already decided how things are going to turn out and why. It's easier to see things that way, even, than to blame it on God. What did he ever do for me, one way or the other? No, it's this bad writer. It's his fault. He cut my son down by writing in a brain tumor. That was chapter one. Suicide or no suicide, that comes just before the epilogue. It's a stupid story.
Listen, she said, troubled.
If they have one of those dial help outfits in your town, maybe you ought to...
They couldn't do anything for me, he said, and it doesn't matter. I want to help you. For Christ's sake, look around out there before you go chicken shit. Get off dope. You said you were going to. The next time you look around, you'll be 40. And your options will mostly be gone.
No, I can't take this. Some other place.
All places are the same unless your mind changes. There's no magic place to get your mind right. If you feel like shit, everything you see looks like shit. I know that. Newspaper headlines, even the signs I see, they all say, yeah, that's right, Georgie, pull the plug. This eats the bird. Listen. No, you listen. Dig your ears out. Getting old is like driving through snow that just gets deeper and deeper. When you finally get in over your hubcaps, you just spin and spin. That's life. There are no plows to come and dig you out. Your ship isn't going to come in, girl. There are no boats for nobody. You're never going to win a contest. There's no camera following you and people watching you struggle. This is it. All of it. Everything.
You don't know what it's like here, she cried.
No, but I know what it's like here.
You're not in charge of my life.
I'm going to send you $500. Olivia Brenner, care of General Delivery, Las Vegas.
I won't be here. They'll send it back.
They won't, because I'm not going to put on a return address.
Throw it away, then.
Use it to get a better job.
No.
Then use it for toilet paper, he said shortly, and hung up. His hands were shaking. The phone rang 5 minutes later. The operator said, will you accept? No, he said, and hung up. The phone rang twice more that day, but it was not Olivia either time. Around 2 p.m, Mary called him from Bob and Janet Preston's house. Bob and Janet, who always reminded him, like it or not, of Barney and Wilma Flintstone. How was he? Good. A lie. What was he doing for Christmas dinner? Going out to Old Custom House tonight for turkey with all the trimmings. A lie. Would he like to come over here instead? Janet had all kinds of leftovers and would be happy to get rid of some. No, he really wasn't very hungry at the minute. The truth, he was pretty well looped, and on the spur of the moment he told her he would come to Walter's party. She sounded pleased. Did he know it was BYOB? When did Wally Hamner have a party that wasn't, he asked, and she laughed. They hung up, and he went back to sit in front of the TV with a drink. The phone rang again around 7:30, and by that time he was nothing as polite as looped. He was pissy-ass drunk. Hello?
Dawes?
Dawes here. Who's there?
Magliore, Dawes. Sal Magliore.
He blinked and peered into his glass. He looked at the Zenith color TV where he had been watching a movie called Home for the Holidays. It was about a family that had gathered at their dying patriarch's house on Christmas Eve, and somebody was murdering them one by one. Very Christmassy. Mr. Magliore, he said, pronouncing carefully. Merry Christmas, sir, and the best of everything in the new year.
Oh, if you only knew how I dread 74, Magliore said dolefully. That's the year the oil barons are going to take over the country, Dawes. You see if they don't. Look at my sales sheet for December if you don't believe me. I sold a 1971 Chevy Impala the other day. This car is clean as a whistle. And I sold it for $1,000. $1,000! Do you believe that? A 45% knockdown in 1 year. But I can sell all the 71 Vegas I can get my hands on for $1,500, $1,600. And what are they, I ask you?
Little cars? He asked cautiously.
They're fucking Maxwell House coffee cans, that's what they are, Magliore shouted. Saltine boxes on wheels. Every time you look at the goddamn things cross-eyed and say booga booga at them, the engine's out of tune or the exhaust system drops off or the steering linkage is gone. Pintos, Vegas, Gremlins, they're all the same, little suicide boxes. So I'm selling those as fast as I can get them, and I can't move a nice Chevy Impala unless I fucking give it away. And you say Happy New Year. Jesus, Mary, Joseph the Carpenter.
That's seasonal, he said.
I didn't call about that anyway, Magliore answered. I called to say congratulations.
Congratulations? He was honestly bewildered.
You know, crackle, crackle, boom, boom.
Oh, you mean...
Psst, not on the phone. Be cool, Dawes.
Sure, crackle, crackle, boom, boom. That's good, he cackled.
It was you, wasn't it, Dawes?
To you, I wouldn't admit my middle name. Magliore roared.
That's good. You're good, Dawes. You're a fruitcake, but you're a clever fruitcake. I admire that.
Thanks, he said, and cleverly knocked back the rest of his drink.
I also wanted to tell you that everything was going ahead on schedule down there. Rumble and roar. What?
The glass he was holding fell from his fingers and rolled across the rug.
They've got seconds on all that stuff, Dawes. Thirds on most of it. They're paying cash until they got their bookwork straightened out, but everything is right on.
You're crazy.
No. I thought you ought to know. I told you, Dawes. Some things you can't get rid of.
You're a bastard. You're lying. Why do you want to call a man up on Christmas night and tell him lies?
I ain't lying. It's your play again, Dawes. In this game, it's always going to be your play.
I don't believe you.
You poor son of a bitch,
Magliore said. He sounded honestly sorry, and that was the worst part.
I don't think it's going to be a very happy New Year for you, either.
He hung up. And that was Christmas. December 26, 1973. There was a letter from them in the mail. He had begun to see the anonymous people downtown that way, the personal pronoun in italics and printed in drippy, ominous letters like the printing on a horror movie poster, as if to confirm what Magliore had said. He held it in his hand, looking down at the crisp, white business envelope, his mind filled with almost all the bad emotions the human mind can feel. Despair, hatred, fear, anger, loss. He almost tore it into small pieces and threw it into the snow beside the house. And then he knew he couldn't do that. He opened it, nearly tearing the envelope in half, and realized that what he felt most was cheated. He had been gypped. He had been rooked. He had destroyed their machines and their records, and they had just brought up a few replacements. It was like trying to fight the Chinese army single-handed. It's your play again, Dawes. In this game, it's always going to be your play. The other letters had been form jobs sent from the office of the highway department. Dear friend, the big crane is going to come to your house sometime soon. Be on the lookout for this exciting event as we improve your city. This was from the city council, and it was personal. It said, December 20th, 1973. Mr. Barton G. Dawes, 1241 Crestallen Street West, M.W. Dear Mr. Dawes, it has come to our attention that you are the last resident of Crestallen Street West who has not relocated. We trust that you are experiencing no undue problems in this matter. While we have a 19642-A form on file, Acknowledgement of Information Concerning City Roads Project 6983-426-73-74-HC, we do not yet have your relocation form, 6983-426-73-74-HC-9004, blue folder. As you know, we cannot begin processing your check of reimbursement without this form. According to our 1973 tax assessment, the property at 1241 Crestallen Street West has been valued at $63,500, and so we are sure that you must be as aware of the situation's urgency as we are. By law, you must relocate by January 20th, 1974, the date the demolitions work is scheduled to begin on Crestallen Street West. We must also point out again that according to the State Statute of Eminent Domain, SL-19452-36, you would be in violation of the law to remain in your present location past midnight of January 19, 1974. We are sure you understand this, but we are pointing it out once more so that the record will be clear. If you are having some problem with relocation, I hope you will call me during business hours, or better yet, stop by and discuss the situation. I am sure that things can be worked out. You will find us more than eager to cooperate in this matter. In the meantime, may I wish you a Merry Christmas and a most productive New Year? Sincerely, John T. Gordon for the City Council. JTG/TK. No, he muttered. You may not wish it. You may not. He tore the letter to shreds and threw it in the wastebasket. That night, sitting in front of the Zenith TV, he found himself thinking about how he and Mary had found out, almost 42 months ago now, that God had decided to do a little road work on their son Charlie's brain. The doctor's name had been Younger. There was a string of letters after his name on the framed diplomas that hung on the warmly paneled walls of his inner office. But all he understood for sure was that Younger was a neurologist. A fast man with a good brain disease. He and Mary had gone to see him at Younger's request on a warm June afternoon, 19 days after Charlie had been admitted to Doctor's Hospital. He was a good-looking man, maybe halfway through his 40s, physically fit from a lot of golf played with no electric golf cart. He was tanned a deep cordovan shade, and the doctor's hands fascinated him. They were huge hands, clumsy-looking, but they moved about his desk, now picking up a pen, now riffling through his appointment book, now playing idly across the surface of a silver-inlaid paperweight, with a lissom grace that was very nearly repulsive. "Your son has a brain tumor," he said. He spoke flatly, with little inflection. But his eyes watched them very carefully, as if he had just armed a temperamental explosive.
"Tumor,"
Mary said softly, blankly. "How bad is it?" he asked Younger. The symptoms had developed over the space of 8 months. First the headaches, infrequent at the beginning, then more common. then double vision that came and went, particularly after physical exercise. After that, most shameful to Charlie, some incidents of bedwetting. But they had not taken him to the family doctor until a terrifying temporary blindness in the left eye, which had gone as red as a sunset, obscuring Charlie's good blue. The family doctor had had him admitted for tests, and other symptoms had followed that. Phantom smells of oranges and shaved pencils, occasional numbness in the left hand, occasional lapses into nonsense and childish obscenity. "It's bad," Younger said. "You must prepare yourself for the worst. It is inoperable." Inoperable. The word echoed up the years to him. He had never thought that words had taste, but that one did. It tasted bad and yet juicy at the same time, like rotten hamburger cooked rare. Inoperable. Somewhere, Younger said, deep in Charlie's brain, was a collection of bad cells roughly the size of a walnut. If you had that collection of bad cells in front of you on the table, you could squash them with one hard hit. But they weren't on the table. They were deep in the meat of Charlie's mind, still smugly growing, filling him up with random strangeness. One day, not long after his admission, he had been visiting his son on his lunch break. They had been talking about baseball, discussing, in fact, whether or not they would be able to go to the American League Baseball playoffs if the city's team won. Charlie had said, "I think if their pitching staff holds up, pitching, He had leaned forward. "What, Fred? I'm not tracking you." Charlie's eyes had rolled wildly outward. "Fred?" George whispered.
"Freddy?"
"Goddamn motherfucking mother-sucking fuckhole,"
his son screamed from the clean white hospital bed.
"Cunt-licking, dink-rubbing, asswipe son of a whoring bitch."
"Nurse," he had screamed, as Charlie passed out.
"Oh, God, nurse."
It was the cells, you see, that had made him talk like that. A little bunch of bad cells no bigger, say, than your average-sized walnut. Once, the night nurse said, he had screamed the word boondoggle again and again for nearly 5 minutes. Just bad cells, you know. No bigger than your garden variety walnut. Making his son rave like an insane dock walloper, making him wet the bed, giving him headaches, making him, during the first hot week of that July, lose all ability to move his left hand. "Look," Dr. Younger had told them on that bright, just right for golf June day. He had unrolled a long scroll of paper, an ink tracing of their son's brainwaves. He produced a healthy brainwave as a comparison, but he didn't need it. He looked at what had been going on in his son's head and again felt that rotten yet juicy taste in his mouth. The paper showed an irregular series of spiky mountains and valleys, like a series of badly drawn daggers. Inoperable. You see, if that collection of bad cells, no bigger than a walnut, had decided to grow on the outside of Charlie's brain, minor surgery would have vacuumed it right up. No sweat, no strain, no pain on the brain, as they had said when they were boys. But instead, it had grown down deep inside, and it was growing larger every day. If they tried the knife, or laser, or cryosurgery, they would be left with a nice, healthy, breathing piece of meat. If they didn't try any of those things, soon they would be bundling their boy into a coffin. Dr. Younger said all these things in generalities, covering their lack of options in a soothing foam of technical language that would wear away soon enough. Mary kept shaking her head in gentle bewilderment, but he had understood everything exactly and completely. His first thought, bright and clear, never to be forgiven, was, "Thank God it's not me." And the funny taste came back, and he began to grieve for his son. Today a walnut, tomorrow the world. The creeping unknown. The incredible dying sun. What was there to understand? Charlie died in October. There were no dramatic dying words. He had been in a coma for 3 weeks. He sighed and went out to the kitchen and made himself a drink. Dark night pressed evenly on all the windows. The house was so empty now that Mary was gone. He kept stumbling over little pieces of himself everywhere.
Snapshots.
His old sweatsuit in an upstairs closet. An old pair of slippers under the bureau. It was bad, very bad to keep doing that. He had never cried over Charlie after Charlie's death, not even at the funeral. Mary had cried a great deal. For weeks, it seemed, Mary had gone around with a perpetual case of pink eye. But in the end, she had been the one to heal. Charlie had left scars on her, that was undeniable. Outwardly, she had all the scars, Mary before and after. Before, she would not take a drink unless she considered it socially helpful to his future. She would take a weak screwdriver at a party and carry it around all night. A rum toddy before bed when she had a heavy chest cold, that was all. After, she had a cocktail with him in the late afternoon when he came home, and always a drink before bed. Not serious drinking by anyone's yardstick, not sick and puking in the bathroom drinking, but more than before. A little of that protective foam, undoubtedly just what the doctor would have ordered. Before, she rarely cried over little things. After, she cried over them often, always in private, if dinner was burned, if she had a flat. The time water got in the basement and the sump pump froze and the furnace shorted out. Before, she had been something of a folk music buff. White folk and blues, Van Ronk, Gary Davis, Tom Rush, Tom Paxton, Spider John Kerner. After, her interest just faded away. She sang her own blues and laments on some inner circuit. She had stopped talking about their taking a trip to England if he got promoted a step up. She started doing her hair at home. And the sight of her sitting in front of the TV in rollers became a common one. It was she their friends pitied. Rightly so, he supposed. He wanted to pity himself, and did, but kept it a secret. She had been able to need, and to use what was given to her because of her need, and eventually that had saved her. It had kept her from the awful contemplation that kept him awake so many nights after her bedtime drink had lulled her off to sleep. And as she slept, he contemplated the fact that in this world, a tiny collection of cells, no bigger than a walnut, could take a son's life and send him away forever. He had never hated her for healing, or for the deference other women gave her as a right. They looked on her the way a young oil man might look on an old vet whose hand or back or cheek is shiny with puckered pink burn tissue, with the respect the never hurt always hold, for the once hurt now healed. She had done her time in hell over Charlie, and these other women knew it. But she had come out. There had been before, there had been hell, there had been after, and there had even been after, when she had returned to two of her four social clubs, had taken up macrame. He had a belt she had done a year ago, a beautiful twisted rope creation with a heavy silver buckle monogrammed BGD. Had taken up afternoon TV, soap operas, and Merv Griffin chatting with the celebrities. Now what? He wondered, going back to the living room. After? It seemed so. A new woman, a whole woman, rising out of the old ashes that he had so crudely stirred. The old oil man, with skin grafts over the burns, retaining the old savvy, but gaining a new look. Beauty only skin deep? No. Beauty was in the eye of the beholder. It could go for miles. For him, the scars had all been inside. He had examined his hurts one by one on the long nights after Charlie's death, cataloging them with all the morbid fascination of a man studying his own bowel movements for signs of blood. He had wanted to watch Charlie play ball on a little league team. He had wanted to get report cards and rant over them. He wanted to tell him over and over to pick up his room. He wanted to worry about the girls Charlie saw, the friends he picked, the boy's internal weather. He wanted to see what his son became, and if they could still be in love as they had been until the bad cells, no bigger than a walnut, had come between them like some dark and rapacious woman. Mary had said, "He was yours." That was true. The two of them had fitted so well that names were ridiculous, even pronouns a little obscene. So they became George and Fred, a vaudeville sort of combination. Two Mortimer Wiebelwiesers against the world. And if a collection of bad cells no bigger than a walnut could destroy all those things that are so personal that they can never be properly articulated, so personal you hardly dared admit their existence to yourself, what did that leave? How could you ever trust life again? How could you see it as anything more meaningful than a Saturday night demolition derby? All of it was inside him, but he had been honestly unaware that his thoughts were changing him so deeply, so irretrievably. And now it was all out in the open, like some obscene mess vomited onto a coffee table, reeking with stomach juice, filled with undigested lumps. And if the world was only a demo derby, wouldn't one be justified in stepping out of his car? But what after that? Life seemed only a preparation for hell. He saw that he had drained his drink in the kitchen. He had come into the living room with an empty glass. December 31st, 1973. He was only two blocks from Wally Hamner's house when he put his hand into his overcoat pocket to see if he had any Canada mints in there. There were no mints, but he came up with a tiny square of aluminum foil that glinted dully in the station wagon's green dashlights. He spared it a puzzled, absent glance, and was about to toss it into the ashtray when he remembered what it was. In his mind, Olivia's voice said, "Synthetic mescaline. Product 4, they call it. Very heavy stuff." He had forgotten all about it. He put the little foil packet back into his coat pocket and turned onto Walter Street. Cars were lined up halfway down the block on both sides. That was Walter, all right. He had never been one to have anything so simple as a party when there might be a group grope in the offing. The principle of the pleasure push, Wally called it. He claimed that someday he would patent the idea and then publish instructional handbooks on how to use it. If you got enough people together, Wally Hamner maintained, you were forced into having a good time, pushed into it. Once when Wally was expounding this theory in a bar, he had mentioned lynch mobs. "There," Walter had said blandly. "Bart has just proved my case." He wondered what Olivia was doing now. She hadn't tried to call back, although if she had, he would probably have weakened and taken the call. Maybe she had stayed in Vegas just long enough to get the money and had then caught a bus for, where, Maine? Did anyone leave Las Vegas for Maine in the middle of winter? Surely not. "Product 4, they call it. Very heavy stuff." He snuggled the wagon up to the curb behind a sporty red GTX with a black racing stripe and got out. New Year's Eve was clear but bitterly cold. A frigid rind of moon hung in the sky overhead like a child's paper cutout. Stars were spangled around it in lavish profusion. The mucus in his nose froze to a glaze that crackled when he flared his nostrils. His breath plumed out on the dark air. Three houses away from Walter's, he picked up the bass line from the stereo. They really had it cranked. There was something about Wally's parties, he reflected, pleasure principle or no. The most well-intentioned of just-thought-we'd-drop-bys ended up staying and drinking until their heads were full of silver chimes that would turn to leaden church bells the next day. The most dyed-in-the-wool rock music haters ended up boogieing in the living room to the endless golden gassers that Wally trotted out when everybody got blind drunk enough to look back upon the late 50s and early 60s as the plateau of their lives. They drank and boogied, boogied and drank, until they were panting like little yellow dogs on the 4th of July. There were more kisses in the kitchen by halves of differing holes, more feel-ups per square inch, more wallflowers jerked rudely out of the woodwork, more normally sober folks who would wake up on New Year's Day with groaning hangovers and horridly clear memories of prancing around with lampshades on their heads, or of finally deciding to tell the boss a few home truths. Wally seemed to inspire these things, not by any conscious effort, but just by being Wally. And, of course, there was no party like a New Year's Eve party. He found himself scanning the parked cars for Steve Ordner's bottle green Delta 88, but didn't see it anywhere. Closer to the house, the rest of the rock band coalesced around the persistent bass signature And Mick Jagger screaming, "Ooh, children, it's just a kiss away, kiss away, kiss away." Every light in the house was blazing. Fuck the energy crisis. Except, of course, in the living room, where rub your peepees would be going on during the slow numbers. Even over the heavy drive of the amplified music, he could hear 100 voices raised in 50 different conversations, as if Babel had fallen only seconds ago. He thought that, had it been summer, or even fall, it would have been more fun to just stand outside, listening to the circus, charting its progress toward its zenith, and then its gradual fall-off. He had a sudden vision, startling, frightening, of himself standing on Wally Hamner's lawn and holding a roll of EEG graph paper in his hands, covered with the irregular spikes and dips of damaged mental function, the monitored record of a gigantic, tumored party brain. He shuddered a little and stuck his hands in his overcoat pockets to warm them. His right hand encountered the small foil packet again, and he took it out. Curious, he unfolded it, regardless of the cold that bit his fingertips with dull teeth. There was a small purple pill inside the foil, small enough to lie on the nail of his pinky finger without touching the edges. Much smaller than, say, a walnut. Could something as small as that make him clinically insane? Cause him to see things that weren't there? Think in a way he had never thought? Could it, in short, mime all the conditions of his son's mortal illness? Casually, almost absently, he put the pill in his mouth. It had no taste. He swallowed it. "Bart!" the woman screamed. "Bart Dawes!" It was a woman in a black, off-the-shoulder evening dress, with a martini in one hand. She had dark hair, put up for the occasion, and held with a glittering rope spangled with imitation diamonds. He had walked in through the kitchen door. The kitchen was choked, clogged with people. It was only 8:30. The tidal effect hadn't gotten far yet, then. The tidal effect was another part of Walter's theory. As the party continued, he contended, people would migrate to the four corners of the house. "The center does not hold," Wally said, blinking wisely. T.S. Eliot said that. Once, according to Wally, he had found a guy wandering around in the attic 18 hours after a party ended. The woman in the black dress kissed him warmly on the lips, her ample breasts pushing against his chest. Some of her martini fell on the floor between them. "Hi," he said. "Who's you?"
"Tina Howard, Bart. Don't you remember the class trip?"
She waggled a long, spade-shaped fingernail under his nose.
"Naughty boy." "That Tina? By God, you are."
A stunned grin spread his mouth. That was another thing about Walter's parties. People from your past kept turning up like old photographs. Your best friend on the block 30 years ago. The girl you almost laid once in college. Some guy you had worked with for a month on a summer job 18 years ago. "Except I'm Tina Howard Wallace now," the woman in the black dress said. "My husband's around here, somewhere." She looked around vaguely, spilled some more of her drink, and swallowed the rest before it could get away from her. "Isn't it awful? I seem to have lost him." She looked at him warmly, speculatively, and Bart could barely believe that this woman had given him his first touch of female flesh. The sophomore class trip at Grover Cleveland High School, 109 years ago. Rubbing her breast through her white cotton sailor blouse beside. "Caught her stream," he said aloud. She blushed and giggled. "You remember, all right." His eyes dropped in a perfect involuntary reflex to the front of her dress, and she shrieked with laughter. He grinned that helpless grin again. "I guess time goes by faster than we..."
"Bart!"
Wally Hamner yelled over the general party babble.
"Hey, buddy, really glad you can make it."
He cut across the room to them, with the also-to-be-patented Walter Hamner party zigzag. A thin man, now mostly bald, wearing an impeccable 1962 vintage pinstriped shirt and horn-rimmed glasses. He shook Walter's outstretched hand, and Walter's grip was as hard as he remembered.
"I see you met Tina Wallace,"
Walter said. "Hell, we go way back when," he said, and smiled uncomfortably at Tina.
"Don't you tell my husband that, you naughty boy," Tina giggled. "Excuse, please. I'll see you later, Bart."
"Sure," he said. She disappeared around a clump of people gathered by a table loaded with chips and dips, and went on into the living room. He nodded after her and said,
"How do you pick them, Walter?"
"That girl was my first feel. It's like this is your life." Walter shrugged modestly.
"All a part of the pleasure push, Barton, my boy."
He nodded at the paper bag tucked under his arm.
"What's in that plain brown wrapper?"
"Southern Comfort. You've got ginger ale, don't you?"
"Sure," Walter said, but grimaced. "Are you really going to drink that down by the Swanee River stuff? I always thought you were a Scotchman."
"I was always a private comfort and ginger ale man. I've come out of the closet." Walter grinned. "Mary's around here someplace. She's kind of been keeping an eye out for you. Get yourself a drink and we'll go find her." "Good enough." He made his way across the kitchen, saying hi to people he knew vaguely and who looked as if they didn't know him at all, and replying hi, how are you, to people he didn't remember who hailed him first. Cigarette smoke rolled majestically through the kitchen. Conversation faded quickly in and out, like stations on late-night AM radio, all of it bright and meaningless. "Freddie and Jim didn't have their timesheets, so I said that his mother died quite recently, and he's apt to go on a crying jag if he drinks too much. So when he got the paint scraped off, he saw it was really a nice piece, maybe pre-revolutionary.
And this little kike came to the door selling encyclopedias.
Very messy. He won't give her the divorce because of the kids, and he drinks like a terribly nice dress. So much to drink that when he went to pay the check, he barfed all over the hostess." A long formica-topped table had been set up in front of the stove and the sink, and it was already crowded with opened liquor bottles and glasses in varying sizes and degrees of fullness. Ashtrays already overflowed with filter tips. 3 ice buckets filled with cubes had been crowded into the sink. Over the stove was a large poster which showed Richard Nixon wearing a pair of earphones. The earphone cord disappeared up into the rectum of a donkey standing on the edge of the picture. The caption said, "We listen better." To the left, a man in bell-bottomed baggies and a drink in each hand, a water glass filled with what looked to be whiskey, and a large stein filled with beer, was entertaining a mixed group with a joke. "This guy comes into this bar, and here's this monkey sitting on the stool next to him. So the guy orders a beer, and when the bartender brings it, the guy says, 'Who owns this monkey? Cute little bugger.' And the bartender says, 'Oh, that's the piano player's monkey.' So the guy swings around." He made himself a drink and looked around for Walt, but he had gone to the door to greet some more guests, a young couple. The man was wearing a huge driving cap, goggles, and an old-time automobile duster. Written on the front of the duster were the words, "Keep on trucking." Several people were laughing uproariously, and Walter was howling. Whatever the joke was, it seemed to go back a long time. Then the guy walks over to the piano player and says, "Do you know your monkey just pissed in my beer?" And the piano player says, "No, but hum a few bars and I'll fake it." Calculated burst of laughter. The man in the bell-bottomed baggies sipped his whiskey and then cooled it with a gulp of beer. He took his drink and strolled into the darkened living room, slipping behind the turned back of Tina Howard Wallace before she could see him and snag him into a long game of "Where are they now?" She looked, he thought, like the kind of person who could cite you chapter and verse from the lives of classmates who had turned out badly. Divorce, nervous disorders, and criminal violations would be her stock in trade, and would have made unpersons out of those who had had success. Someone had put on the inevitable album of 50s rock and roll, and maybe 15 couples were jitterbugging, hilariously and badly. He saw Mary dancing with a tall, slim man that he knew but could not place.
Jack? John? Jason?
He shook his head. It wouldn't come. Mary was wearing a party dress he had never seen before. It buttoned up one side, and she had left enough buttons undone to provide a sexy slit to a little above one nylon knee. He waited for some strong feeling, jealousy or loss, even habitual craving, but none came. He sipped his drink. She turned her head and saw him. He raised a non-committal finger in salute. "Go on and finish your dance." But she broke off and came over, bringing her partner with her. "I'm so glad you could come, Bart," she said, raising her voice to be heard over the laughter and conversation in stereo.
Do you remember Dick Jackson?
Bart stuck out his hand, and the slim man shook it. You and your wife lived on our street 7 years ago, is that right?
Jackson nodded. We're out in Willowwood now.
Housing development, he thought.
He had become very sensitive to the city's geography and housing strata.
Good enough. Are you still working for Peel's?
No, I've got my own business now. 2 trucks.
Tri-state haulers. Say, if that laundry of yours ever needs day hauling, chemicals or any of that stuff.
I don't work for the laundry anymore, he said, and saw Mary wince slightly as if someone had knuckled an old bruise.
No, what are you doing now?
Self-employed, he said, and grinned.
Were you in on that independent trucker strike?
Jackson's face, already dark with alcohol, darkened more.
You're goddamn right. And I personally untracked a guy that couldn't see falling into line. Do you know what those miserable Ohio bastards are charging for diesel? 31.9. That takes my profit margin from 12% and cuts it right down to 9. And all my truck maintenance has got to come out of that 9. Not to mention the frigging double nickel speed limit.
As he went on about the perils of independent trucking in a country that had suddenly developed a severe case of the energy bends, Bart listened and nodded in the right places and sipped his drink. Mary excused herself and went into the kitchen to get a glass of punch. The man in the automobile duster was doing an exaggerated Charleston to an old Everly Brothers number, and people were laughing and applauding. Jackson's wife, a busty, muscular-looking girl with carroty red hair, came over and was introduced. She was quite near the stagger point. Her eyes looked like the tilt signs on a pinball machine. She shook hands with him, smiled glassily, and then said to Dick Jackson,
"Hun, I think I'm going to whoopsie. Where's the bathroom?"
Jackson led her away. He skirted the dance floor and sat down in one of the chairs along the side. He finished his drink. Mary was slow coming back. Someone had collared her into a conversation, he supposed. He reached into an inside pocket and brought out a pack of cigarettes and lit one. He only smoked at parties now. That was quite a victory over a few years ago, when he had been part of the 3-packs-a-day cancer brigade. He was halfway through the cigarette and still watching the kitchen door for Mary, when he happened to glance down at his fingers and saw how interesting they were. It was interesting how the first and second fingers of his right hand knew just how to hold the cigarette, as if they had been smoking all their lives. The thought was so funny he had to smile. It seemed that he had been examining his fingers for quite a while, when he noticed his mouth tasted different. Not bad, just different. The spit in it seemed to have thickened. And his legs felt a little jittery, as if they would like to tap along with the music. As if tapping along with the music would relieve them, make them feel cool and just like legs again. He felt a little frightened at the way that thought, which had begun so ordinarily, had gone corkscrewing off in a wholly new direction, like a man lost in a big house and climbing a tall crystal staircase. There it was again. And it was probably the pill he had taken, Olivia's pill, yes. And wasn't that an interesting way to say crystal? Crystal gave it a crusty, bangled sound like a stripper's costume. He smiled craftily and looked at his cigarette, which seemed amazingly white, amazingly round, amazingly symbolic of all America's padding and wealth. Only in America were cigarettes so good tasting. He had a puff. Wonderful. He thought of all the cigarettes in America pouring off the production lines in Winston-Salem. A plethora of cigarettes. An endless, clean, white cornucopia of them. It was the mescaline, all right. He was starting to trip. And if people knew what he had been thinking about the word crystal, also known as crystal, they would nod and tap their heads. Yes, he's crazy, all right. Nutty as a fruitcake. Fruitcake, there was another good word. He suddenly wished Sal Magliore was here.
Together, he and Sally One Eye would discuss all the facets of the organization's business. They would discuss old horrors and shootings. In his mind's eye, he saw Sally One Eye and himself eating linguine in a small Italian ristorante with dark-toned walls and scarred wooden tables, while the strains of The Godfather played on the soundtrack, all in luxurious technicolor that you could fall into, bathe in like a bubble bath. "Crystal," he said under his breath and grinned. It seemed that he had been sitting here and going over one thing and another for a very long time. But no ash had grown on his cigarette at all. He was astounded. He had another puff. "Bart?" He looked up. It was Mary, and she had a canapé for him. He smiled at her. "Sit down." "Is that for me?" "Yes." She gave it to him. It was a small triangular sandwich with pink stuff in the middle. It suddenly occurred to him that Mary would be frightened, horrified, if she knew he was on a trip. She might call an emergency squad, the police, God knew who else. He had to act normally. But the thought of acting normal made him feel stranger than ever. "I'll eat it later," he said, and put the sandwich in his shirt pocket. "Bart, are you drunk?" "Just a little," he said. He could see the pores on her face. He could not recall ever having seen them so clearly before. All those little holes, as if God was a cook and she was a pie crust. He giggled, and her deepening frown made him say, "Listen, don't tell." "Tell?" She offered a puzzled frown. "About the product four." "Bart, what in the name of God are you..." "I've got to go to the bathroom," he said. "I'll be back." He left without looking at her, but he could feel her frown radiating out from her face in waves, like heat from a microwave oven. Yet if he didn't look back at her, it was possible she would not guess. In this, the best of all possible worlds, anything was possible, even crystal staircases. He smiled fondly. The word had become an old friend. The trip to the bathroom somehow became an odyssey, a safari. The party noise seemed to have picked up a cyclical beat. It seemed to fade in and fade out in syllables of three, and even the stereo faded in and out. He mumbled to people he thought he knew, but refused to take up a single-thrown conversational gambit. He only pointed to his crotch, smiled, and walked on. He left puzzled faces in his wake. "Why is there never a party full of strangers when you need one?" he scolded himself. The bathroom was occupied. He waited outside for what seemed like hours, and when he finally got in, he couldn't urinate, although he seemed to want to. He looked at the wall above the toilet tank, and the wall was bulging in and out in a cyclical three-beat rhythm. He flushed, even though he hadn't gone, in case someone outside might be listening, and watched the water swirl out of the bowl. It had a sinister pink color, as if the last user had passed blood, unsettling. He left the bathroom, and the party smote him again. Faces came and went like floating balloons. The music was nice, though. Elvis was on. Good old Elvis. Rock on, Elvis. Rock on. Mary's face appeared in front of him and hovered, looking concerned. "Bart, what's wrong with you?" "Wrong? Nothing wrong." He was astounded, amazed. His words had come out in a visual series of musical notes. "I'm hallucinating." He said it aloud, but it was spoken only for himself. "Bart, what have you taken?" She looked frightened now. "Mescaline," he said. "Oh, God, Bart! Drugs? Why?" "Why not?" he responded, not to be flip, but because it was the only response he could think of quickly. The words came out in notes again, and this time some of them had flags. "Do you want me to take you to a doctor?" He looked at her, surprised, and went ponderously over her question in his mind to see if it had any hidden connotations, Freudian echoes of the funny farm. He giggled again,
and the giggles streamed musically out of his mouth, and in front of his eyes, crystal notes on lines and spaces broken by bars and rests. "Why would I want a doctor?" he said, choosing each word. The question mark was a high quarter note. "It's just like she said. Not that good, not that bad, but interesting." "Who?" she demanded. "Who told you? Where did you get it?" Her face was changing, seeming to become hooded and reptilian. Mary as cheap mystery movie police detective, shining the light in the suspect's eyes. "Come on, McGonagall, whichever way you want it, hard or soft." And then, worse still, she began to remind him uneasily of the H.P. Lovecraft stories he had read as a boy, the Cthulhu mythos stories, where perfectly normal human beings changed into fishy crawling things at the urgings of the Elder Ones. Mary's face began to look scaly, vaguely eel-like. "Never mind," he said, frightened. "Why can't you leave me alone? Stop fucking me up. I'm not bothering you." Her face recoiled, became Mary's again, Mary's hurt, mistrustful face, and he was sorry. The party beat and swirled around them. "All right, Bart," she said quietly. "You hurt yourself just any way you like, but please don't embarrass me. Can I ask you that much?" "Of course you can." But she had not waited for his answer. She left him, going quickly into the kitchen without looking back. He felt sorry, but he also felt relieved. But suppose someone else tried to talk with him? They would know, too. He couldn't talk to people normally, not like this. Apparently, he couldn't even fool people into thinking he was drunk. "Reet," he said, ruffling the R's lightly off the roof of his mouth. This time the notes came out in a straight line, all of them, hurrying notes with flags. He could make notes all night and be perfectly happy. He didn't mind. But not here, where anybody could come along and accost him. Someplace private, where he could hear himself think. The party made him feel as if he were standing behind a large waterfall. Hard to think against the sound of all that. Better to find some quiet backwater, with perhaps a radio to listen to. He felt that listening to music would aid his thinking. And there was a lot to think about, reams of things. Also, he was quite sure that people had begun to glance over at him. Mary must have spread the word.
"I'm worried. Bart's on mescaline."
It would move from group to group. They would go on pretending to dance, pretending to drink, and have their conversations. But they would really be observing him from behind their hands, whispering about him. He could tell. It was all crystal clear. A man walked past him, carrying a very tall drink and weaving slightly. He twitched the man's sport jacket and whispered hoarsely,
"What are they saying about me?"
The man gave him a disconnected smile and blew a warm breath of scotch in his face. "I'll write that down," he said, and walked on. He finally got into Walter Hamner's den. He could not have said how much later. And when he closed the door behind him, the sounds of the party became blessedly muted. He was getting scared. The stuff he had taken hadn't topped out yet. It just kept coming on stronger and stronger. He seemed to have crossed from one side of the living room to the other in the course of one blink, through the darkened bedroom where coats had been stored, in another blink, down the hall in a third. The chain of normal waking existence had come unclipped, spilling reality beads every which way. Continuity had broken down. His time sense was el destructo.
Suppose he never came down. Suppose he was like this forever.
It came to him to curl up and sleep it off. But he didn't know if he could. And if he did, God knew what dreams would come. The light, spur-of-the-moment way he had taken the pill now appalled him. This wasn't like being drunk. There was no small kernel of sobriety winking and blinking down deep in the center of him, that part that never got drunk. He was wacky all the way through. But it was better in here. Maybe he could get control of it in here by himself. And at least, if he freaked out, he wouldn't... "Hi there." He jumped, startled, and looked into the corner. A man was sitting there in a high-backed chair by one of Walter's bookcases. There was an open book on the man's lap, as a matter of fact. Or was it a man? There was a single light on in the room, a lamp on a small round table to the speaker's left. Its light cast long shadows on his face, shadows so long that his eyes were dark caverns, his cheeks etched in sardonic, malefic lines. For a moment he thought he had stumbled on Satan sitting in Wally Hamner's den. Then the figure stood, and he saw it was a man, only a man, a tall fellow, maybe 60, with blue eyes and a nose that had been repeatedly punched in losing bouts with the bottle. But he wasn't holding a drink, nor was there one on the table. "Another wanderer, I see," the man said and offered his hand. "Phil Drake." "Barton Dawes," he said, still dazed from his fright. They shook. Drake's hand was twisted and scarred by some old wound, a burn, perhaps. But he didn't mind shaking it. Drake. The name was familiar, but he couldn't remember where he had heard it before. "Are you quite all right?" Drake asked. "You look a little..." "I'm high," he said. "I took some mescaline, and oh boy, am I high." He glanced at the bookcases and saw them going in and out, and didn't like it. It was too much like the beating of a giant heart. He didn't want to see things like that anymore. "I see," Drake said. "Sit down. Tell me about it." He looked at Drake, slightly amazed, and then felt a tremendous surge of relief. He sat down. "You know about mescaline?" he asked. "Oh, a little. A little. I run a coffee house downtown. Kids wander in off the streets, tripping on something." "Is it a good trip?" he asked politely. "Good and bad," he said. "It's heavy. That's a good word, the way they use it." "Yes, it is." I was getting a little scared. He glanced out the window and saw a long celestial highway stretching across the black dome of the sky. He looked away casually, but couldn't help licking his lips. "Tell me, how long does this usually go on?" "When did you drop?" "Drop?" The word dropped out of his mouth in letters, fell to the carpet, and dissolved there. "When did you take the stuff?" "Oh, about 8:30. "And it's..." He consulted his watch. "It's 9:45 now."
9:45? Is that all?"
Drake smiled. "The sense of time turns to rubber, doesn't it? I expect you'll be pretty well down by 1:30.
"Really?"
"Oh, yes, I should think so. You're probably peaking now. Is it very visual, Mesk?"
"Yes, a little too visual."
"More things to be seen than the eye of man was meant to behold," Drake said, and offered a peculiar, twisted smile.
"Yes, that's it. That's just it."
His sense of relief at being with this man was intense. He felt saved. "What do you do besides talk to middle-aged men who have fallen down the rabbit hole?"
Drake smiled.
"That's rather good. Usually people on mesk or acid turn inarticulate, sometimes incoherent. I spend most of my evenings at the Dial Help Center. On weekday afternoons, I work at the coffee house I mentioned, a place called Drop Down Mama. Most of the clientele are street freaks and stew bums. Mornings, I just walk the streets and talk to my parishioners if they're up, and in between, I run errands at the county jail."
"You're a minister?"
"They call me a street priest. Very romantic. Malcolm Boyd, look out. At one time, I was a real priest."
"Not anymore?"
"I have left the Mother Church," Drake said.
He said it softly, but there was a kind of dreadful finality in his words. He could almost hear the clang of iron doors slammed shut forever.
"Why did you do that?"
Drake shrugged.
"It doesn't matter."
"What about you? How did you get the mesk?"
"I got it from a girl on her way to Las Vegas. A nice girl, I think. She called me on Christmas Day."
"For help?"
"I think so."
"Did you help her?"
"I don't know." He smiled craftily.
Father, tell me about my immortal soul.
Drake twitched. I'm not your father.
Never mind, then.
What do you want to know about your soul?
He looked down at his fingers. He could make bolts of light shoot from their tips whenever he wanted to. It gave him a drunken feeling of power. I want to know what will happen to it if I commit suicide.
Drake stirred uneasily. You don't want to think about killing yourself while you're tripping. The dope talks, not you.
I talk, he said. Answer me.
I can't. I don't know what will happen to your soul if you commit suicide. I do, however, know what will happen to your body. It will rot. Startled by this idea, he looked down at his hands again. Obligingly, they seemed to crack and molder in front of his gaze, making him think of that Poe story, The Strange Case of M. Valdemar. Quite a night. Poe and Lovecraft. A. Gordon Pym, anyone? How about Abdul Alhazred, the mad Arab? He looked up, a little disconcerted, but not really daunted.
What's your body doing? Drake asked.
Huh? He frowned, trying to parse sense from the question.
There are two trips, Drake said. A head trip and a body trip. Do you feel nauseated, achy, sick in any way?
He consulted his body.
No, he said. I just feel busy.
He laughed a little at the word, and Drake smiled.
It was a good word to describe how he felt. His body seemed very active, even still. Rather light, but not ethereal. In fact, he had never felt so fleshy, so conscious of the way his mental processes and physical body were webbed together. There was no parting them. You couldn't peel one away from the other. You were stuck with it, baby. Integration, entropy. The idea burst over him like a quick tropical sunrise. He sat chewing it over in light of his current situation, trying to make out the pattern, if there was one, But there's the soul, he said aloud.
What about the soul? Drake asked pleasantly.
If you kill the brain, you kill the body, he said slowly, and vice versa. But what happens to your soul? There's the wild card, Mr. Drake.
Drake said, In that sleep of death, what dreams may come? Hamlet, Mr. Dawes.
Do you think the soul lives on? Is there survival?
Drake's eyes grayed.
Yes, he said, I think there is survival in some form.
And do you think suicide is a mortal sin that condemns the soul to hell? Drake didn't speak for a long time. Then he said, Suicide is wrong. I believe that with all my heart.
That doesn't answer my question. Drake stood up. I have no intention of answering it. I don't deal in metaphysics anymore. I'm a civilian. Do you want to go back to the party?
He thought of the noise and confusion and shook his head.
Home?
I couldn't drive. I'd be scared to drive.
I'll drive you.
Would you?
How would you get back?
Call a cab from your house. New Year's Eve is a very good night for cabs.
That would be good, he said gratefully.
I'd like to be alone, I think. I'd like to watch TV.
Are you safe alone? Drake asked somberly.
Nobody is, he replied with equal gravity, and they both laughed.
Okay, do you want to say goodbye to anyone?
No. Is there a back door?
I think we can find one.
He didn't talk much on the way home. Watching the streetlights go by was almost all the excitement he could stand. When they went by the roadwork, he asked Drake's opinion.
They're building new roads for energy-sucking behemoths while kids in this city are starving, Drake said shortly.
What do I think? I think it's a bloody crime.
He started to tell Drake about the gasoline bombs, the burning crane, the burning office trailer, and then didn't. Drake might think it was an hallucination.
Worse still, he might think it wasn't.
The rest of the evening was not very clear. He directed Drake to his house. Drake commented that everyone on the street must be out partying or to bed early. He didn't comment. Drake called a taxi. They watched TV for a while without talking. Guy Lombardo at the Waldorf Astoria making the sweetest music this side of heaven. Guy Lombardo, he thought, was looking decidedly froggy. The taxi came at 11:45. Drake asked him again if he would be all right. Yes, I think I'm coming down. He really was. The hallucinations were draining toward the back of his mind. Drake opened the front door and pulled up his collar. Stop thinking about suicide. It's chicken. He smiled and nodded. But he neither accepted nor rejected Drake's advice. Like everything else these days, he simply took it under advisement. Happy New Year, he said.
Same to you, Mr. Dawes.
The taxi honked impatiently. Drake went down the walk, and the taxi pulled away, yellow light glowing on the roof. He went back into the living room and sat down in front of the TV. They had switched from Guy Lombardo to Times Square, where the glowing ball was poised atop the Alice Chalmers building, ready to start its descent into 1974. He felt weary, drained, finally sleepy. The ball would come down soon, and he would enter the new year tripping his ass off. Somewhere in the country, a New Year's baby was pushing its squashed, placenta-covered head out of his mother's womb and into this best of all possible worlds. At Walter Hamner's party, people would be raising their glasses and counting down. New Year's resolutions were about to be tested. Most of them would prove as strong as wet paper towels. He made a resolution of his own on the spur of the moment and got to his feet in spite of his tiredness. His body ached and his spine felt like glass, some kind of hangover. He went into the kitchen and got his hammer off the kitchen shelf. When he brought it back into the living room, the glowing ball was sinking down the pole. There was a split screen showing the ball on the right, showing the merrymakers at the Waldorf on the left, chanting, 8, 7, 6, 5. One fat society dame caught a glimpse of herself on a monitor, looked surprised, and then waved to the country. The turn of the year, he thought. Absurdly, goosebumps broke out on his arms. The ball reached the bottom, and a sign lit up on the top of the Alice Chalmers building. The sign said, 1974. At the same instant, he swung the hammer, and the TV screen exploded. Glass belched onto the carpet. There was a fizz of hot wires, but no fire. Just to be sure the TV would not roast him during the night in revenge, he kicked out the plug with his foot. Happy New Year, he said softly, and dropped the hammer to the carpet. He lay on the couch and fell asleep almost immediately. He slept with the lights on, and his sleep was dreamless. Part 3. January. If I don't get some shelter, oh, I'm gonna fade away. Rolling Stones. January 5th, 1974. The thing that happened in the Shop and Save that day was the only thing that had happened to him in his whole life that actually seemed planned and sentient, not random. It was as if an invisible finger had written on a fellow human being, expressly for him to read. He liked to go shopping. It was very soothing, very sane. He enjoyed doing sane things very much after his bout with the mescaline. He had not awakened on New Year's Day until afternoon, and he had spent the remainder of the day wandering disconnectedly around the house, feeling spaced out and strange. He had picked things up and looked at them, feeling like Iago examining Yorick's skull. To a lesser degree, the feeling had carried over to the next day, and even the day after that. But in another way, the effect had been good. His mind felt dusted and clean, as if it had been turned upside down, scrubbed and polished by some maniacally brisk internal housekeeper. He didn't get drunk, and thus did not cry. When Mary had called him, very cautiously, around 7 p.m. on the 1st, he had talked to her calmly and reasonably,
and it seemed to him that their positions had not changed very much. They were playing a kind of social statues, each waiting for the other to move first. But she had twitched and mentioned divorce, just a possibility, the veriest wiggle of a finger, but movement for all that. No, the only thing that really disturbed him in the aftermath of the mescaline was the shattered lens of the Zenith color TV. He could not understand why he had done it. He had wanted such a TV for years, even though his favorite programs were the old ones that had been filmed in black and white. It wasn't even the act that distressed him as much as the lingering evidence of it. The broken glass, the exposed wiring. They seemed to reproach him, to say, "Why did you go and do that? I served you faithfully, and you broke me. I never harmed you, and you smashed me. I was defenseless." And it was a terrible reminder of what they wanted to do to his house. At last, he got an old quilt and covered the front of it. That made it both better and worse. Better because he couldn't see it. Worse because it was like having a shrouded corpse in the house. He threw the hammer away like a murder weapon. But going to the store was a good thing. Like drinking coffee in Benji's Grill, or taking the LTD through the Clean Living Car Wash, or stopping at Henny's Newsstand downtown for a copy of Time. The Shop and Save was very large, lighted with fluorescent bars set into the ceiling, and filled with ladies pushing carts and admonishing children and frowning at tomatoes wrapped in see-through plastic that would not allow a good squeeze. Muzak came down from discreet overhead speaker grills, flowing evenly into your ears to be almost heard. On this day, Saturday, the S&S was filled with weekend shoppers, and there were more men than usual, accompanying their wives and annoying them with sophomoric suggestions. He regarded the husbands, the wives, and the issue of their various partnerships with benign eyes. End of side 15. To continue, turn the cassette over.